So thank you all for coming. My name's Jenny Lyon, for those of you who don't know me. So you may know me through QED Actuarial and previously Ads Acumen Resources. Anyway. So thank you first to the Institute for hosting us and to Lisa for setting up the session for us and running another insight session for us. I'm delighted to see so many people here and showing an interest in this subject. So I'm doing a very brief introduction today because since I left QED, I've been doing a number of things and actually taking some of my own advice for once and having a think about what I wanted to do moving forward. One of the things I'm doing is chairing the leadership committee for the Institute, so I hope that you've all been noticing a few more leadership items out there. But I've also been doing some voluntary work with Opportunity International. And I approached them about whether they were interested in me coming along and doing something for a variety of reasons, I guess. I'd developed an interest in microfinance, mainly through some of the sessions that we've had through the Institute, where or individuals that I've spoken to have perhaps gone and worked in India for a few weeks on a microinsurance project. I think it's a great model that they have, and so that interested me to find out a little bit more. I was also interested in really seeing a not-for-profit and how it operated from the inside, and that's been an interesting experience too. And I was looking for something where I felt that I could make a worthwhile contribution. And I guess the reason that I identified Opportunity was what interests me is that they give individuals, and in many cases, particularly women, the opportunity to empower themselves and their families moving forward, and that it's a sustainable benefit to them. While I've been there, I've been impressed particularly with their professionalism and very much so the dedication of the people who are working there. I've been astounded at how many volunteers they have. I thought the Institute had a lot of volunteers, but they do have a lot of people who give a lot of time on a voluntary basis. They've got a strong focus on transparency and were recently winners of the PwC Transparency Awards, but that's very evident to me working there that they're very focused on understanding how the money that people give them is being used and how it can be used to the best effect. And one of the most recent things that I've found interesting there is looking at the work that they're doing, looking at social performance measurement and how do you actually measure what's happening at a social level as well as just looking at it from a financial point of view. So that's all I'm going to say, other than to thank, obviously, Rebecca and Sarah, who will introduce you much more to what microfinance is all about. So thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. We really love having her on board as well, so I just want to thank you for the warm introduction. That's really kind. It's great to have such a dedicated volunteer, so thank you. Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to the Microfinance Masterclass. Appreciate you taking time out of your day, and I hear this is kind of a good turnout, so that's great. We feel very honored. We appreciate being here today. Opportunity International is a global microfinance organization. We passionately believe that microfinance is an effective poverty alleviation tool. We do operate as a non-for-profit, and essentially our role is raising tax-deductible donations in Australia, which we then send to our microfinance institutions, partners, we'll call them MFIs for the next 90 minutes, you'll hear that a lot, and then they then lend out that money to the poor. We operate overseas. We are a global organization, as I said, and the Australia arm focuses on Indonesia, India, and the Philippines. For the sake of today's presentation, we'll focus a little bit more on India, but that's just for the sake of a case study. We do operate all over the world. We have about 40 years of experience, 2.7 million clients, just to give you a bit of a scope. So we've been around a long time, since pretty much the beginning of microfinance. And it's a real honor to share our story and pull back the curtain a bit on what microfinance is. I'm Sarah Marino, the Donor Relations Manager at Opportunity International Australia. My background is in nonprofit development, so I've been in the nonprofit sector for always. love working in the community, love working for a nonprofit, and what really got me into microfinance was when I went back to school and I got my MBA, I realized that there was this amazing opportunity to have a sustainable benefit. So what really gets me out of bed in the morning is the empowerment that we offer our clients, but I've been doing it a little while, and I can tell you that this is something, the sustainability of this intervention is really impressive and really what keeps me motivated. So it's exciting to share that with you today. My co-presenter is Rebecca Parkinson, and she'll do an introduction to herself, and then we'll get going.
Thanks, Sarah. Yes, hi, I'm Rebecca. This is me in the Philippines with a group of women who had received group loans. My background is in investment banking and finance, and I'm the investment services director at Opportunity. I work with our field partners and our relationship managers to make sure that the deals we do are mission aligned and that our partners are delivering the best services to our clients. And I also report on the performance of our partners internally and to donors.
Okay, so today our goal with this masterclass is really, can everybody see? Our goal is really to just first and foremost trigger your interest in what microfinance is. Some of you may have heard about it, some of you haven't. But what we want to do is just encourage you to learn more. We hope that you know, instills a desire, inspires some action on your part, whatever that might mean for you. But really our intention for today is just to pull back the curtain, take a closer look, really get into the nitty-gritty and see what microfinance is, how it works, and look at all the inner workings of it. So that's our goal for today. The agenda, as you see here, we're going to talk about poverty. We'll do that fairly briefly, just kind of paint the picture. And it's really just, we do that in order to sort of set the scene for who our clients are and the space that we're working in. Then we're going to speak about microfinance. We'll talk about the products and services that we offer specifically. We'll talk about some of the global regulations, the size of the industry, et cetera. And then we'll close with some current issues or some hot topics. They may not be hot topics to some people, but to us, they're pretty interesting. We're going to discuss interest rates, which is really exciting. And then we're also going to speak about some of the current trends in the industry, what are some of the new models that we're using in terms of impact measurement, client protection, et cetera. So if that sounds all right to everybody, we'll go ahead and get going. We will leave about 15, 20 minutes for questions at the end, so feel free to hold questions for there. But if you have some burning question, raise your hand. Happy to take questions as we go along as well. But we will leave some time at the end as well. Sound good? All right, let's do this. So poverty, we hear about it all the time, and I think sometimes unfortunately, it can almost lose meaning because we do hear about it so often. But the fact is that 50% of the world is living in extreme poverty. The World Bank determines that as $1.25 a day. We usually use it in terms of $2 a day. But there are 2.7 billion people in the world who are living on every day less than what we, most of us, spend on a coffee. So this situation is extreme and worthy of the attention that it's getting. These are some further facts to set the stage a little bit, to show us the scope of the work we're doing. 790 million people are still chronically undernourished. They're not getting enough food in order to sustain themselves in a healthy way. They don't have enough energy to work. They don't have nutrition, et cetera. 2.6 billion people have no access to basic sanitation. 1.1 billion don't have access to clean drinking water. This obviously impacts further health problems when you don't have access. And every 3.6 seconds, someone in the world dies from starvation. So this is a very serious situation. The statistics are staggering. They're not meant to scare you or make you feel guilty or anything like that. They're just meant to show that the need for poverty alleviation tools such as microfinance is extremely necessary, and it's extremely important. It's an immediate need, and that's what we're here for. So what does that really look like, though? Those are the numbers. This is a picture that we took when we were visiting our clients in India. This is pretty typical. This is the kind of situation that most of our clients are living in. This is a rubbish tip in India. Most of our clients are living in areas that, you know, aren't even sort of categorized as residential or safe to habitate. This is a very typical situation. So that's what it looks like. But what are the actual qualities of the poor? We know it's a scary number. We know that it's a sad view. But what are the actual qualities of the poor that make microfinance a viable solution? There's a couple different things, and it's multifaceted. It's very complicated. But here's what we boil it down to. First and foremost, they're highly vulnerable to catastrophe. So that means when there is an earthquake, a typhoon, a flood, they don't have the means to find a better situation, to get help, to escape to a safer place. The options aren't there. So they're exceptionally vulnerable to things like that happening, the inevitable crises in life that happen to all of us. But the poor simply don't have the resources to avoid them. Similarly with the health crisis in the family, which because of sanitation, et cetera, they tend to have those types of crises more often. The poor are lacking in basic skills, typically. So even if you're not an actuary or someone in finance, most people in the developed world have a basic sense of financial skills. They make X dollars a month. They spend Y dollars a month. There's certain, you know, financial business skills that are fairly basic and assumed that we're all taught from a young age. And this doesn't tend to occur in poor communities. So they're lacking basic business financial skills that contribute to productivity. And they lack essential services. When they get sick, there very rarely is a doctor for them to go to, even if they could afford that doctor. Education is not assumed. I just got back from Indonesia, and we visited a village where it was a lucky situation where there was a school only 2 kilometers away, but that school only went up to age 11, which means none of the children in the village are going to go to high school. So the high school was 20 kilometers away. They simply can't reach it. You can't send a 12-year-old to walk to school 20 kilometers every day there and back. It's just not an option. So they don't have access to education. And we already discussed not having access to sanitation and financial services. These, of course, are generalizations. So I do want to say that up front. But it's what we see trends in our clients that we see when we go out and visit our clients in the field. The thing that we focus on, though, even though all these things are true, and these are the things that maybe get far less attention, unfortunately, the poor are incredibly creative people. They know how to do a lot with a little. When you're given one piece of the pie, you're sort of forced to do many different things within it to make the most of it. So we find that our clients are very creative. They have very innovative solutions. They trend that way. They're very creative people. They're also extremely hardworking. Sometimes in the West, we might see poverty as a dysfunction of society. Maybe it's because somebody has a mental health issue. Maybe it's because they have a drug issue. Again, this is a generalization. That's not the case that we've seen with our clients. They're not poor because of some sort of dysfunction in the family or because of something they've done. They're simply poor because they have no money. They're incredibly hardworking people. You know, a client that we just met in India a few months ago, she's saying every day she's up at 5 a.m. and she's working till 11 p.m. This is 7 days a week. There's no paid time off, et cetera. They're very, very hardworking, and they really want the opportunity to work. And the other thing that I think is most inspiring is that they're very forward-thinking and they're very family-focused. So when we speak to our clients, almost always when we say, what do you want to do with this loan, or what do you hope this, you know, helps you achieve, it's almost always family-focused. So it's, I want my children to go to university. And they dream as big as anybody else here does. They don't have smaller visions for their future. They don't want fewer things for their children. And this is really setting the scene for why microfinance works, because they're creative, they're hardworking, they're often very entrepreneurial, and they're focused on investing that income generation into their families for the future. So that's what we see when we talk about the poor. Are there any questions about poverty? I think we'll move on to microfinance, unless we have anything anybody's dying to address. No? Okay, all right. So now we'll talk about microfinance. So microfinance is just one way to alleviate poverty. We don't believe it's a silver bullet. We don't believe it's the only thing that's necessary. But we found that it's an extremely effective solution to a multifaceted problem. Microfinance essentially is the provision of financial products and services to the poor. So it's not just loans. It's all financial products and services. In 1970, this gentleman right here That's David Bissot. He founded Opportunity International in the early 70s. At about the same time, Muhammad Yunus in Bangladesh, Al Whitaker in the U.S., and David, who's originally a Kiwi, lives in Australia, and he was in Indonesia, were visiting developing countries and realized that the poverty they were seeing was unacceptable to them, and that all the poor really needed was a hand up, not a hand out. So they all reached in their own pockets, made the first loan, and microfinance, then from there just kind of grew in popularity. But it all really started from these three individuals who just decided to do something about it, who said, this isn't okay with me, this isn't acceptable, and they're all sort of business people and had that sort of business acumen and said, we think this is the best way to help these people. And so that's what they did. Since then, microfinance has grown from tiny cooperatives, from these few individuals just reaching in their own pockets, to a major global industry. So I'm probably standing in front of this, aren't I? There's an estimated 3,500 microfinance institutions in the world right now. That number's changing all the time. In 2010, the estimated lending value of MFIs was $75 billion, so that's how much was out in loans. There's 100 million clients worldwide. These are 2010 numbers. And it operates in nearly every region in the developing world. And there's all different kinds of players in microfinance. So Opportunity International is a social microfinance organization. That's one type. But we have all sorts of different players. So when you hear microfinance, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a charity or there's social focus, which we'll get into a little bit more later. It started out with philanthropists, NGOs, then the UN and the World Bank got involved, individual donors, and now it's quite diversified for investment bank, funds management, mutual funds that are solely invested in MFIs, et cetera. So it's a pretty diverse industry now. Deutsche Bank, Citibank, they're all involved in microfinance. I think recently, the closest stat I have is 2009, which I apologize, that's out to date. But there was $11 billion being managed by investment funds that were solely invested in microfinance organizations. So, and this is a lot of this growth has even happened in the last 5 or 10 years. So it's an enormous industry. It's highly diverse. And that means that the types of products and the types of service offered are also highly diverse. But I just wanted to point out that it's a big industry and all microfinance is not created equally. Go to the map now. And this can show you that despite the enormous size of the industry and how many different players there are, there's still enormous need in terms of financial inclusion. So I don't expect you to have to read this tiny light gray type, but essentially what this is saying is the lighter it is on the map, the better the financial inclusion is. The darker it is, the greater need for financial inclusion there is. So as you see, there's still many different areas that are sometimes 67, 70% plus unbanked. That means people don't have a place to put their money. They don't have a place to safely transact with their money. They don't have a place to get insurance, get a savings product, et cetera. So the need is still extremely great. In Africa, the way people get money from place to place without remittance programs is by giving it to the bus driver, and then the bus driver takes 30%. If you've ever been walking to a Western Union, even today they're taking 25% to transfer money. So, people need to have these products in terms of financial inclusion to be able to productively move themselves out of poverty. So just wanted to show you this to say, the need is still great despite technology. All right, and now Rebecca's going to talk a little bit more about the actual loan, the credit products that we offer and the services that encompass microfinance together.
Thanks, Sarah. Yeah, so we're going to drill down into how microfinance is delivered to clients in the end, a bit more into the model, and as Sarah said, the types of products that are delivered. So what I'm about to explain to you will not be news to any of you guys, but it might be news in this context, in a micro context. But basically, philanthropists and social investors, like Opportunity, will invest either debt or equity, sometimes grants, into microfinance institutions. I'm probably going to refer to those as MFIs, microfinance institutions. These MFIs are based in country and they run their own programs and design their own products specifically for their clients. lots of clients. I guess there's two features of microfinance that makes it a really appealing model to reach large numbers of people. Those two features are recycling and leverage. Neither of these concepts will be new to you either, but the concept of leverage just means that any investment that we make or a philanthropist or investor makes into a microfinance institution is seen as a sign of financial strength and security of that institution. They can then go and borrow on the commercial market and extend the funds available to them and then lend on to more people. The second concept is that of recycling. This simply refers to the fact that every loan that is made is repaid by clients. And so this group of women receive loans, they repay that back in 6 months or 12 months. They have repaid those funds, they're on lent to someone else, repaid, on lent, and so on and so forth. So it just means that these two features make microfinance a really attractive way of addressing a particularly complex problem and reaching more and more people. So the traditional product, I guess, is the loan. We know that as microcredit. Microcredit has historically been delivered as group loans to groups of women who will borrow $100 to $200 in their first loan cycle. They will. The loan terms are generally quite short, 6 months to 12 months, and the interest rates, which Sarah will talk about a bit later, can vary depending on the country and the particular circumstances of the clients. But microfinance is much broader than microcredit. It covers a number of different other financial products, like, for example, remittances. Sarah referred to the fact or how important it is to be able to transfer funds safely and cheaply between locations. Micro savings as well. For clients to have a safe place to put their funds is just as important as it is for us. Many people will have to resort to keeping their spare cash literally in a tin under their bed or in the bamboo poles of their homes. Obviously, that makes them very vulnerable to theft or to particular disasters. So savings are really important. Microinsurance. I'm sure everyone in the room is very familiar with the importance of insurance. And even more so, given the vulnerability of our clients, is insurance to cover health surprises, particular catastrophes in from environmental risks, income insurance, death insurance. That's very popular, actually, amongst our clients because funerals can be really expensive and is often very culturally important. And then pensions. Pensions is a new area, particularly in India, where we're seeing growth. For example, the government of India has said that they will actually match any funds saved for retirement by the poor in India. They'll match it up to 1,000 rupees a year. 1,000 rupees is about $50. So if a client can save that much, the government will match it. The problem that we have is that where are they going to save it and how do they record it? So what the microfinance model does with its starting point of credit is it provides a distribution platform and a connection for the government to be able to reach out to these clients and then who can then take advantage of this matching system. And I think that volume of 1,000 rupees or $50 is really, it can be quite shocking. For us, it's not a lot of money, but for the poor, that can mean an enormous amount. But on top of that, the microfinance model also allows us to deliver a lot of other services. We call them complementary services, and they involve market linkages, connecting up people who may be in agricultural development up with a market for their products so they can receive the best price. Financial and legal literacy is really important. Sarah referred to the lack of education that many of our clients face. Skills training in particular industries and traditional community development, which might cover health or water and sanitation. I just wanted to give you an example of some particular themes, I guess, in the sector. What we're seeing is, in particular for microcredit, MFIs are becoming more and more client-focused and starting to tailor their products to specific client needs. So one particularly innovative solution that our partner in Indonesia, TLM, developed along with the World Bank was a food security loan. This is a group of clients who took advantage of it. This is grain. The product actually had two components, a credit component and a savings component. So what TLM were observing amongst their clients is that in the lean periods, there was a real shortage of food, and that actually coincided with the planting season. So the credit product involved lending out grain to these clients. The clients would then repay that during harvest, and any surplus they could then store with TLM in a secure storage facility, and that was their savings product. We're also seeing examples of innovation. One of our partners in India called Magdashak, they have a beekeeping loan where they lend out access to the hives. Clients then produce honey and Magdashak will buy that back at a fixed price once the bees have done their produce their honey. And that's an example of a market linkage that's tailored to specifically to their client base. So we're seeing really innovative loans. There's a number of MFIs doing water and sanitation loans where clients who have proved their credit record after 3 or 4 loan cycles can access a larger loan to build a toilet or, as a community, get access to water and sanitation or improve their wells. And this is particularly popular. But I guess the question is, what impacts which services can be provided? So why isn't everyone doing all these innovative loans? Well, there's a number of factors that influence the services and products. They involve the regulatory environment. Every country regulates finance, and particularly microfinance, in a different way. The overall mission of the entity governs, I guess, where their focus is, and the ownership structure of entities. So this is just an example of some particular types of ownership structures that we see in the market. You can have profit-maximising shareholders. In particular, we tend to see those in Eastern Europe and also sometimes in India. There's also government-owned co-ops in China. That tends to be more common. In Latin America, NGOs have transformed into MFIs in some cases, and they tend to have socially-minded shareholders. And then member-owned co-ops, we see them in Africa, in India, in a number of different locations. I guess the commonality between all of these entities is they all seek to be financially sustainable, i.e. cover their costs with their revenue. But I guess, and they will do that by charging fees or interest on the credit that they're issuing. I guess the distinguishing factor between these types of entities is what they do with any profit that they earn. And that distinguishes social from commercial microfinance institutions. So a social MFI, and we at Opportunity International will only support social microfinance, will do things like, if they're starting to make a profit, they might actually decide to reduce their interest rate and cut their profit because they realise that the cheaper that they can provide their products to their clients, the better it is for the client. They may decide to expand into underserved communities and particularly hard-to-reach areas. This is always going to be more expensive, but an MFI that is really after serving the poor and their client base will seek to expand into these areas. And they may invest in complementary services like health or education initiatives. I guess one of the other distinguishing factors between a social and a commercial MFI is that commercial MFIs will often operate in areas that are easier to reach. What that can mean is that clients can have access sometimes to 3, 4, or 5 different institutions to borrow from. We particularly see that in some denser, more densely populated cities in India and in the Philippines. I guess if the MFI isn't really focused on the client's financial position and their capacity to repay debt, they could be just searching for a growth in client numbers to the expense of the client's circumstances. So some of this, what we do is we work with our partners to make sure they have systems in place to control client indebtedness. That's a particular area of focus, particularly the last few years. And it's one of the key areas which distinguish social and commercial microfinance. I'm going to talk a bit more about specific client protection practices later, but we wanted to show you the example of Anna and her story. This clip just goes for 90 seconds, I think, and the difference that social microfinance can make in a client's life.
Kapag sinula ka sa mababa, marunong tumingin sa pinanggalingan mo. Pag dito nakarating ako, akala ko, gandito na lang din ako. Kasi pag uwi namin sa bahay, walang pagkain. Kanya-kanya kami magkakapalit, paano kami makakain. Ang alam namin, mabuti yun. Nasusuka ka na sa mga dumi na nahahawakan mo, naaamoy mo. Parang immune na ako, parang gusto ko mamahalin yung sariwang hangin. Yung maganda yung malinis ako, yung maayos ako. Kasi dati, hanggang tambakan na lang din ako. Kasi kami nga pa na magkakapatid, eh, puro kami scavenger. Sarili ko, napakawalang kwentang tao naman kung habang buhay doon na lang ako. Maging success na, tunay na success na talaga ako na ipagmamalaki ko.
And there is a 6-minute version of Anna's story on our website, so and on YouTube, if you want to take a look and see her full story and have those details filled in, I'd really recommend it. She's a fantastic success story who we've just met with again recently, and she's doing really great. So great story. I'd really encourage you to look out her, look for the full one. All right, now we're going to discuss, as promised, the hot topics, the interesting bits, the current trends, and the first topic we'd like to cover is interest rates. So just a quick show of hands, who here thinks that socially focused microfinance institutions should charge an interest rate? Raise your hand if you think that we should charge an interest rate. Yeah, I guess I probably could have guessed that from the title, but it's not always not everybody always agrees. we do charge interest rates, as mentioned, so that's no secret. Those interest rates are typically regulated. In India, for example, they can't be higher than 26% a year. But it's a very complex issue. It's something that at Opportunity we're constantly thinking about and speaking to our partners about, making sure that it's the right interest rate. And there's a lot of issues and factors that go into it. So what I wanted to do is go through a few of those factors, things that enter into the equation, and then also look at it from the MFI's point of view and the client's point of view. So the first thing to keep in mind when talking about interest rates in microfinance is that, as I said before, financial education is not something that the poor necessarily have, but the cost of capital is a financial concept that they completely understand. So from a very young age, they understand that money is not free. They're very used to having local money lenders. It's a presence in the communities that they're from most of the time. So they understand the idea that money comes at a cost. Their alternatives to that capital are what sort of separate it and make what we do necessary. So, for example, the money lenders, the other alternative to credit outside of microfinance for the unbanked, would be charging approximately 25% interest per day. Per day. So they'll borrow 5 pesos in the morning, 6 or 7 are due at the end of the day. This is almost impossible to pay back. So what ends up happening is that you get in a situation of intergenerational debt sometimes. Now, sometimes there are very high-margin businesses, and they are able to pay that back. But typically, you know, you do have a situation of the poor being taken advantage of by local moneylenders. So that's another thing that we consider. Like I said, their microfinance businesses tend to have very high margins. So paying an interest rate, a reasonable interest rate, is something that is achievable and that is well within, you know, a reasonable situation that can easily be offset. And the other thing, thing we look at it is repayment rate. So as Beck mentioned, we have exceptionally high repayment rates, 97-98% on average. So almost all of our loans are paid back on time. And with interest. So that says to us, one of the things that says to us that interest rates are a reasonable thing to ask of our clients in order to be financially sustainable. Does that all set well with everybody? Yeah? Okay. So the reasons why interest rates are helpful from the MFI point of view, a couple points. The first one is that, as we mentioned, our goal is to create financially sustainable organizations. We don't want to be dependent on donor dollars. We do fundraise a lot in Australia and other developed countries in order to invest in capacity building, leadership training, due diligence, all of those things. And some of that money does go to loan portfolio. But our hope is that we can help our partners become financially sustainable, that the interest that they charge covers the cost of implementing the loan. So that's always the direction we're heading in, always what our goal is. And the interest rate helps us cover that cost so they can become sustainable. The second thing to note from the MFI point of view is that implementing microfinance is extremely expensive. There's a reason that commercial banks didn't get involved until 5 or 10 years ago. It costs a lot of money to lend out these funds in, you know, remote areas and sometimes dangerous areas and areas where, you know, our loan officers are typically servicing, it depends on the partner, sometimes as low as 80 clients, sometimes as many as 150, 200. So that's, you know, it's a very costly way of doing business. And they're meeting with every client weekly or fortnightly, sometimes monthly, but most of the time more often than that. So it's a very, it's an expensive way to lend out money for sure. It's very high touch, it's very personal, and it needs to be to work. But that means that the interest rates have to cover that expense in order to be sustainable. Now, from the client's point of view, the interest rate is also important. For logistical reasons, it's important that they pay an interest rate in order to build a credit history. So we don't want our clients lending from us for 10 years. We want them taking out a series of loans, building a credit history, building a business, becoming sustainable themselves, so they're able to go to a commercial bank and enter the formal banking sector. So in India, for example, it's regulated. You can't take out a microfinance loan for more than $1,000. That's extremely high. We very rarely do that anyways. But the idea is that our clients would graduate beyond that and need to go to a commercial bank and have a financial identity. It's one of the reasons why I love that picture of the two women with their loan sheet, their payment sheet. This, in most cases, not most, in a lot of cases, the first time that our clients are seeing their name in print is when they receive their loan. So this is an incredibly empowering activity, and building that credit history gives them that identity, gives them that financial identity so they can walk into a bank after they've taken out 5-6 loan cycles maybe from us and move into the formal sector. So from a client point of view, it's incredibly important in terms of their journey out of poverty. The most important reason why we charge an interest rate is for the sake of empowerment and dignity. That is at the heart of what we do with all of our partners and all of our programs. And what the interest rate does is that it allows us to have an equal relationship with our clients. It's a business relationship. It's not aid. It's not a handout. It's not us looking down on them because they need us. It's a very equal relationship, and our goal is always to create, to treat and our clients with the utmost dignity, so we're empowering them to be sustainable and to generate their own income to pull themselves out of poverty. So the interest rate establishes that relationship as fair and equal. Does anybody have any questions about interest rates? No? Oh, that's easy. Oh, yeah, there's one question there. Sure. It varies by country. It varies by partner. Around 20 to 25% tends to be what we charge. That's an average. It does vary significantly, so don't go home and say all microfinance loans are charged at 20%, but it is an average. So we do stick right around probably the low to mid-20s for most of our Indian partners. It absolutely varies by country and partner, though. And that regulation is actually new. That just was implemented in December. Yes?
What's the typical loan duration?
6 to 12 months. Yeah, 6 to 12 months. So in the initial loan cycles, it's shorter. If it's a larger loan, up to 24 months, but most of the time it's 6 to 12 months. Great. Okay, now we're going to talk about the financial situation in Andhra Pradesh facing the microfinance industry. We talked about that.
Thanks, Sarah. Just on the interest rates charged, as Sarah said, it does vary. And in the Philippines, it can be a lot higher than 26. India is actually one of the most efficient countries to operate in for microfinance. But you can see rates, effective interest rates, up around 50%. But that it's because MFIs are working in particularly difficult to reach areas and expensive areas. And I guess the point is, what are they doing with that profit? Are they repatriating that back to owners, or are they sowing that back into good products for their clients? And that's the question that I would encourage you to keep in mind when you hear some of these rates that sound shocking to us here. But I'm just going to talk a bit about a couple of topics in particular that illustrate some of these concepts that we've been elaborating on. I'm going to talk about India and Andhra Pradesh, as I said, then look at client protection, and then look at how we try and answer the question, is microfinance actually making a difference in clients' lives? So in India, the debate over what a reasonable interest rate is, client over-indebtedness, and social versus commercial goals has been really starkly illustrated in the last couple of years. In July 2010, SKS, one of India's largest MFIs, listed on their stock exchange. That IPO raised $358 million US and valued the company at $44 billion. So, large entity. I think they had 7 million clients. Yeah, so large. I guess this IPO and the wealth it generated for the promoters raised a lot of questions in India about whether microfinance was actually helping clients. And it stirred controversy. In AP, the media started to pick up on stories where clients had felt indebted and had even gone as far as to commit suicide, and the media drew a line between the microfinance activities and the clients' excessive pressure that caused them to make that terrible decision. The controversy impacted not just Andhra Pradesh, which is this state here, but the whole of India. And commercial banks started to get really uneasy about lending into microfinance, and commercial funding pretty much dried up. This caused what we call a bit of a crisis in the sector. And I guess the governments in both Andhra Pradesh and the national government of India decided that they needed to bring in some regulations to control what the sector was doing, and to control what particular MFIs were doing. The RBI set up a committee called the Malagam Committee, and they brought in a number of recommendations. Those recommendations on controlling the sector have been defined in legislation which is still has been passed by the Cabinet, effectively, but not by the Parliament yet. And those regulations we actually welcome. We welcome because they put the focus right back onto clients who for us, are to be the main beneficiaries. Some of the regulations include capping loan amounts and a total indebtedness cap of 50,000 rupees, that's $1,000. That's actually quite high. But if clients can access loans from several MFIs, then their indebtedness could, if they have five loans at $200, it could easily reach up to this $1,000 quite quickly. And that can be an awful lot of money for people to pay back. So some of the other requirements are around appropriate assessments of client indebtedness and having procedures in place that can effectively assess what a client's financial positions are, position is. Larger loans need to have longer terms, and clients choosing their repayment methods, weekly, fortnightly, monthly, something we completely take for granted in Australia. So as I said, we really welcome this because it's done a number of things. It has started to increase confidence in the sector, and we are seeing funds flowing back to to MFIs, particularly socially focused MFIs, but it's still hard. And it's put the focus back onto people living in poverty. As I mentioned before, there are different ways to ensure that clients are actually benefiting. And there's a campaign at the moment, well, it's called the SMART campaign. Most MFIs are signing up to 7 client protection principles, and these include things like designing products and delivering products in a way that's actually going to be beneficial. So when we say product design, we mean the term of the loan, the size of the loan, the repayments they're making, how they make repayments, whether it's at a branch office or whether the loan officer can go to their home or to their community to collect repayments. Prevention of over-indebtedness. Our partners have been working on this and have procedures in place for a while. I actually went to a partner in the Philippines, and their method for assessing someone's indebtedness was to actually ask the client's neighbours if that person had other loans. And so, I mean, they would ask the client, but then they would go and verify that with the people living in their own community. Not something I think we would appreciate here, but it was acceptable in that circumstance and really quite important for making sure that the client is not going to take out a loan that they can't service. Responsible pricing is around actually calculating the interest rate and communicating what the effective interest rate is in a way that clients can understand. And actually, some of these principles, our partners are going so far as to translate them into the languages, well, so they should really, translate them into the languages that their clients can understand. ESAF, one of our partners in India, has translated these into 7 languages, and they display all of these principles in every branch office that they have, and they explain what they mean to the clients in the terms that they can understand. I guess any MFI that claims to be socially focused must sign up to those principles, and more than sign up, must actually look at how they implement them throughout their operations. And we support our partners in conducting what we call social audits. So we do financial audits. There's always an external financial audit of our partners, but we also do our own financial audits of their operations and systems. But social audits are also really important, where we go into the MFI and we look at what their operational processes are, how they're implementing them. And then we may go out and talk to clients and ask the clients to explain back to us the features of their loan or the product they're receiving to check that they actually understand their obligations.
Yep. Happy clients.
Happy clients. So we know that the products that can be delivered and the services, but what does it take for a client to actually benefit from a loan? Well, there's a number of just basic principles. Their business needs to have the potential to earn an income, and they need to have access to a market that can give them a reasonable price for the product or service that they are delivering. They also need to be able to invest any income or profit into productive sources, either back into their business or into an alternate business. Many of our clients, many microfinance clients, actually have a diverse number of businesses, which allows them to manage their risk with different cycles within the year. And being able to invest profit back into their business or another one is really important. But sometimes clients may choose to invest their profit back into education, which is a long-term asset builder. And it means it might not be until the next generation that they start to see real change in their living conditions and circumstances as their children get educated and are able to earn a reasonable income. So we know that the foundation for microfinance is the right services delivered in the right way. But how do we measure impact? Well, this is the million-dollar question. And I guess what we wanted to tell you today is that there are tools and techniques that are being invested in to help us answer that really tricky question. How do we know that someone is being lifted out of poverty? One of those tools is called the Progress Out of Poverty Index, PPI, for those in the industry. And this is an index of 10 country-specific questions which allows us to assess the probability that a client is living on less than $1.25 a day. So it doesn't tell us that they are, but it allows us to assess the probability, which I presume is a concept you're all very familiar with. The 10 questions, I've got the Indian one here actually. One of the questions here is, what is the primary source of energy for cooking? And clients can choose from one of three options. And number A is firewood and chips or dung cake. B is LPG or electricity. And the third option is they have no cooking arrangement. Another question is, does the household possess an almirah or a dressing table? So these questions have been designed specifically for the Indian context to be able to help us assess the probability, as I said, that clients are living in poverty. And the PPI, once you get a statistically acceptable sample size, helps us do two things. I guess it helps us understand how poor an MFI's client base is and to target particular clients within that base. And it also helps us to track change over time. So you go to the same group of people, ask the same questions 1 year, 2 years, 3 years later, and you can see if there's change over time. It also helps us assess the relative effectiveness of different financial products. Of course, like any survey, it has its limitations. The data can be hampered no matter how well you train loan officers to collect the information. There can be issues in how they ask the questions. Another issue that we have faced in India is the government tends to give out in some states and districts free gas cooking stoves. So that question about what your primary source of cooking would be will obviously be skewed. But I guess whilst it's imperfect, it's an example that there are tools around to help us assess impact. And for Opportunity International, it's something that we're really investing heavily into to be able to answer this question. This is just one tool that we use as part of our social performance management program, which Jenny, I think you mentioned, was particularly interesting to you. So I guess the key issue for us at Opportunity is how to increase our outreach and how to increase our impact. The rapid growth in the Indian, in particular microfinance sector, has seen a lean and efficient model that's adept at distributing credit to large numbers of people on scale, and particularly now that we're coming through the crisis, we're seeing that ramping up again and again. However, the one-size-fits-all model is not doesn't necessarily work. India in particular is a country with diverse states and districts. And I guess the capacity and the willingness of institutions to invest in tailored solutions to their own client base is really critical. But the network and the model of microfinance does provide an excellent platform to deliver not only credit services, but those other financial services, microfinance, microinsurance, savings accounts, pensions, remittances, as well as other essential services like health and education. And I guess as we'd like to ramp up funding permitting over the next few years and increase that platform and the reach of the model. I guess we wanted to show you an example of where impact is really apparent in a community, and we're going to show you the Rope Weavers of Kerta story. Again, this just goes for 90 seconds, so enjoy.
One of the great things about that video is we've had the chance to revisit that group of clients every 6 months for the last few years. And when we were back in October, you saw kind of their little factory that they had set up there and built the concrete floor. When we were back in October, it had concrete walls. And then we went back in January, and then it had a roof. So it's really exciting to see kind of their growth over time as a group loan. And what that's allowed them to do is not just grow their business, but also stabilize the business, because they live in an area that's really susceptible to monsoons. So they've been able to protect their business, so they're able to work year-round. So it's those kinds of things that the multiple loan cycles that allows people to slowly and effectively walk their journey out of poverty themselves. So I think that's a fantastic indicator of what we do and how we do it. So microfinance, and we'll just wrap up, and then looks like we have a good chunk of time for questions, which is great. So why do we provide microfinance? There's certainly been criticism on the industry. We hope we've addressed, with total transparency, what we do, why we do it, how we measure it. But ultimately, we do it because we can see it's having a positive impact on clients' lives, and that's why we're here. We're here to help alleviate global poverty, and we believe it's a sustainable tool. It's a sustainable business model, and that's one of the reasons why we believe in it so much. It uses leverage to increase the power of the capital raised. So our average leverage is 2.5 times. It can be as high as 6 times in parts of the world. So we believe that that ability to leverage is a fantastic benefit to microfinance funding. The loans are recycled, as Becht mentioned, you know, with a 97% repayment rate. The money that was lent out, paid back, lent out again, so that money is constantly being recycled, which is highly effective. And it empowers people. You know, that's the biggest selling point for me, at least. It's empowering people to pull themselves up. It's a hand up, not a handout, and it really does help people transform their lives. So it's an essential service that we believe everybody deserves to, you know, have access to financial services so they're able to do this for themselves and their family. And we're really confident that microfinance is one of the more promising poverty alleviation tools. Even though the numbers are staggering and the problem can seem very large, we really believe that we have the ability to overcome that and to solve those problems and to allow people to help themselves and transform their lives to really have lasting impact. So that's our summary of sort of why we do what we do. We hope that's a bit of what you took away as well. But now we'll just move on to sort of kind of what's next. We encourage you to keep learning. It's an ever-changing industry. There's a lot of different players. There's a lot of information out there from a lot of different sources. So we just would really encourage you to keep on learning about microfinance, keep on learning about poverty and what we can all do about it together. There's a lot of different ways to do that. The UN has classes online. We have a number of papers and research on our website. You know, when you're traveling, we encourage you to have a look around and really, you know, see the communities that you're visiting and kind of look past to the people who are living there as well. So we just encourage you to really keep learning and keep diving, you know, deeply into the subject. It's a very rich topic, and we believe it can be really meaningful and inspiring. We'd also encourage you to give generously any way that you can. Maybe that's of your time, your expertise, your money through workplace giving, through matched giving, through your company. There's a number of ways for both organizations and individuals to get involved in donating time and resources. It doesn't take much to lift somebody out of poverty. $100 is our average loan size, so we certainly encourage you to give any way that works in your life and that that speaks to you. And lastly, we just ask you to shout loudly. So tell people that you came here today, tell people what you learned, and just encourage other people to get involved. The power of networks will help us alleviate poverty together. So we just encourage you to get out there and keep talking about it and keep all this front of mind for people. Of course, we have social media platforms to make that easier for you, so encourage you to do that. But really, it's just about shouting loudly what you took away here today. You will be receiving an email from the Institute in the next couple of days from us with some follow-up materials and just saying thanks, as well as there's some materials in the back, little pocket-sized cards that kind of summarize what we discussed today, as well as business cards if you want to get in touch with Opportunity and learn more or have any feedback. And Beck and I will be up here for the next few moments as well, taking any questions. And the last thing is we do have International Poverty Day coming up at the end of October, and there'll be a number of events around that. So whether it's through Opportunity or somebody else, just encourage you to keep learning, keep shouting, and give as generously as you can to help us continue doing the work that we do. So thank you very much. We'll take questions if you all have some. Yes. Yeah.
Mm.
Sure. There's all, when I say give, of course, donating, you know, money is one of those ways to give, but it's only one way. There's a number of different ways to give back. So everybody understands that we take donations and how we spend them, so we'll leave that aside. The other ways to give would be volunteering. That's one way. We can set up volunteering opportunities for skilled volunteering. You obviously all have skills that would be useful. So there are opportunities to give here in Australia to share your expertise professionally. There are some opportunities But they tend to be specific and more limited to actually go into one of our MFI partners and work. So we ask for a greater commitment. If somebody's going to go off into the field and work with one of our MFI partners, we have done it before. We have a gentleman right now who's an engineer who's working in Indonesia on a well project that we have going. So we've definitely done projects like that before, what we would call sending volunteers to the field. All of our market research tells me not to use that phrase, to the field, but that's essentially what it is. So, yes, we do have opportunities like that. It would be personalized, one-off. You would let us know what your skills are and what you're interested in, and then we would match you up with an MFI. So those are some ways to do it. We do have other opportunities in the workplace and things like that, which we can talk about offline as well. But, yes, certainly volunteering opportunities in Australia and overseas are available. And there are some fellowship programs for other MFIs that we work with.
So presumably there are a lot of barriers behind that kind of virtual volunteering work, and that's why it isn't as prominent as it potentially could be.
I mean, it's of course, there's language barriers, there's cultural barriers, so it's just a large investment of the individual's time who's donating it, as well as the organizational time to train people. It's a very sensitive population, and it's a complicated model. And so when we put people and partner them with our MFIs, we just want to make sure it's set up for success so it's a good experience for everybody. Again, it's just a customized, personalized thing. We do it a few times a year. It's definitely an option, but it would be more one-off, yeah. Does that answer your question? Yeah, great. And we can talk. I'm available to talk more about that specifically as well if anybody has questions.
Really just picking up on that last question, can you expand a bit more about what skills you're looking for people here in Australia, please?
We have, I guess in terms of volunteers specifically, we tend to craft projects in particular and then advertise them, or if people have approached us with a need, then we'll try and match them up with their skill set. I guess if I can use Jenny as an example... Jenny came to us last year and I guess we saw her background and thought she seems like a capable kind of person. And then the number of projects that she's been involved in have been really varied for opportunity, from risk assessment through to partner assessment and some knowledge management work. So I guess... it's about us getting to know the individual and what your capacity is, how much time you're able to give, what your skill set is, and then tailoring a project that fits. The other way to volunteer your time or your energies is to introduce us to your corporates or your work, your workplaces. So we can do this kind of session as a professional development session, or you could introduce us to your workplace giving program if any of your corporates run those kind of programs. And another way that people really give of their time if they are completely sold on our model is to become ambassadors for us, and that allows you, or we equip you then to go out into your networks and really educate you more on microfinance, and so that you can talk amongst your networks and increase the, broaden... out those who understand what we do, and
I think that pretty much covers. I know right now we have a real strong need for some IT support, so if anybody is an IT expert, we have plenty of IT problems that need solving right now in our office, so that's one area of expertise, and also in marketing and web development. Those are two areas where we currently have availability. So I'll just leave it at that. And if people are interested, we can do it more one-off. You had a question?
Actually, two questions, I guess. Given the micro nature of it, the money must transfer through a lot of hands, say from somebody giving $100 in Australia to $100 actually being in the pockets of these ladies to do their rope job. Is there a typical structure as to how it gets there? And I guess a related question would be, is there much corruption?
It's a good question. It's a big one. So we're always looking for ways to streamline it. In fact, our CEO of one of our partners in the Philippines came out in February and said that right now there are 11 steps to loan repayment, and his first job as the new CEO is to get that down to 3 steps because it can be so varied. The way that it works is that a dollar is donated in Australia. We then invest in equity and debt into the MFI partners, which they're able to commercially leverage up, as we mentioned, an average of 2.5 times, but it does vary per partner. Then the microfinance institution lends out that money, and the repayment of the loan is done via the loan officer. So for larger loans, sometimes the clients will actually go to the branch and repay the money in cash. For group loans, oftentimes the loan officer will go out to the group lending, the lending groups, and collect the payment weekly or fortnightly, as we mentioned, and then take it back to the branch. There are some security issues with that. We've overcome them mostly. It's not a common thing, but it is something we have to keep in mind because people are paying in cash. So there's, you know, the challenges of cash. We are looking into and starting to implement more mobile technology, and that's something that we're hoping will be able to take advantage of. It helps us in cost. It helps us in security. But the thing about mobile technology, a lot of people are really fired up about it, as they should be. It's a great opportunity. Technology is helping us immensely. But at the same time, we don't want it to replace the loan officer because a lot of training, support, encouragement, all of those mentorship and educational activities happen via the loan officer. And so we would not want to eliminate that entirely, even if it would increase the efficiency. That's what separates us from a normal bank or from a commercial microfinance organization. So that's sort of the cycle. So that's the first. Does that answer your first question? Okay, and I'm going to let Beck handle the corruption question.
Well, I mean, it is an issue, and I guess for us, one of the things we're really focused on is having an auditable trail. So that process that Sarah just outlined, every step of that process is auditable. That doesn't mean that frauds don't happen in microfinance institutions. If you're talking about thousands and thousands of cash transactions every day in remote places, that happens. But we spend a lot of time with our partners equipping them and reviewing their operational processes to make sure the controls are there and conducting audits on those to try and control and minimise the risk of fraud. But it is an issue, and particularly with the flow of cash around. I mean, we would recommend all our MFIs have cash protection insurance for their branches. So, I guess it's about having a really good controls all the way along that step and making sure the loan officers are trained well and paid appropriately and incentivized to perform their jobs and not be tempted.
Another thing about that is that we're a social organization. We're a nonprofit. Our microfinance institutions are social MFIs. So it attracts a certain type of employee. I'm not saying it doesn't happen because we're all nice people. That's not but it does attract a certain kind of employee. You don't come to work for a social microfinance institution to become rich. You know, they're people who are very socially driven, and as a rule, we're constantly impressed by the values and the ethics and the procedures in place to protect us from that kind of thing at the minute level. The other thing to think about is that Opportunity has a policy that we don't operate in areas of conflict, so we try to avoid sticky government situations. We do that because that's not where microfinance is most effective. But it also, you know, we have sort of distant but peaceful relationships with government is our goal. We're not heavily entrenched in that, except to the, you know, degree of necessary regulations and structures and all of that. Of course, we're compliant. But we don't go into areas that are war-torn or have, you know, challenging government situations or that type of thing for the most part. We really try to avoid that, and that helps with avoiding corruption as well.
Just an associated question. For every dollar that's contributed, how much of that actually gets paid across? So, you know, what percentage is administration, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And then in terms of the loans that are provided, what sort of credit assessment is done to ensure repayment of those loans?
So to answer your first question, our administrative cost is 17%. With microfinance, that number, you're not comparing apples to apples with other charities, so I'd encourage you to not think of it in that terms. I mean, that is well within accepted practices. 20% or less is a good fundraising administration ratio for a nonprofit. Ours is about 17%. That doesn't account for the repayment, though. So if you do it over 10 years, it's less than 1%. But 17% is the easy answer to that question. And then the second question was about, remind me. Risk assessment.
So each partner will have their own ways of assessing the credit risk, and it's not about going into a community and just splashing money around. A relationship is generally formed with groups of women, and the group loan is the first step for most microfinance clients. So there's a couple of things, but one of them is that the groups often tend to self-select themselves, so or each other, so they know who in their community that they're happy to trust, because often they're going co-guarantee for each other. So there is a little bit of, trusting the community to self-select themselves. But then there are other ways of assessing the existing indebtedness of clients, like the example I gave earlier where they ask the client what current loans they have and who they have loans with, but then they'll go and the loan officer will go and check that with their neighbours. So, each partner will do it differently, but there's some of the ways to assess. They will also talk to them about their businesses. The loan officer will know about the business and the particular circumstances that people are working in, the businesses. Does that answer your question?
You pointed out that exposure to catastrophe is, in fact, one of the great problems that can affect people in poverty. So in giving business loans to organisations and groups, do you normally expect them to take out some form of microinsurance? Or how do you deal with those sorts of contingencies, the crop fails or there's a flood or whatever else that happens to affect potentially quite a few clients simultaneously? Mm.
So I guess the first thing that a loan officer would do is work with the client on if there is the potential for them to repay back. In due course, possibly an MFI may need to write off some of their loan book, and all MFIs make provisions for that. In terms of insurance, usually it's not the microfinance institution themselves that's providing cover, but they will have an alliance with a micro insurer. And more we're seeing those products being provided to clients. So I guess there's a couple of steps before you get to the point of completely writing off a portion of your loan book. But that really distinguishes and the extent to which you will continue to push a client to make repayments is another distinguishing factor between whether you would like to benefit the client or whether you're really after protecting the quality of your loan portfolio, so social versus commercial. I'm not entirely sure of the stats on how many of our clients have particular types of insurance, but I can definitely follow that up with you afterwards. It's a lot. It's a large proportion, but I don't want to make generalisations because there's so many different types of microinsurance, health and death and income and... yeah. That's right.
So you mentioned that you don't operate in war-torn countries, for example, but also that talking about billions of people in poverty initially. Mm-hmm. How big is the untapped market for this kind of thing? And is it expanding? Are there barriers to that expanding?
Yeah, we had an event the other night. Christina Keneally is one of our ambassadors. I did an event with her last week. Beck was there at the Taj Foundation. And one of the questions we got, and I am answering your question, one of the questions we got was, isn't that a problem? And we basically said no, because they still have plenty of clients. So, yes, there is a huge amount of people who still need these services. You know, like I said, there's still 2.7 billion people in the world living on less than $2 a day. 75% of India doesn't, you know, people don't have toilets there. You know, most of all the regions that we're operating in, 50-60% of the population are living in extreme poverty. The problem is enormous. We're doing some plans in Indonesia to expand fairly significantly over the next 5 years. And the recent assessment, and these are initial figures, have come up with the fact that we're probably reaching 5% of the people who need our services in Indonesia right now. It's not good enough. We need to be doing more of it. More people need to be doing it with a social focus. But we need to make sure that it's the right product in the right situation. And trying to do this quickly isn't the answer. So we're really focused on pulling people out of poverty, not giving people loans. So it's a journey. It's a process. And it's constantly the struggle that we look at. You know, so many people need our help, but we have to make sure we're focused on still doing it well with the clients in mind and in the right kind of situation. You know, there are so many people who have so many needs, and in the war-torn areas or areas of, you know, government unrest or violent situations, you know, they need our help just as much, and the poverty there is extreme as well. But we're just focused on microfinance and financial inclusion as the tool, and it just doesn't work in those regions. We've gone into areas before too soon, before it wasn't peaceful enough, and it's unsafe for everybody, and it makes the progress almost impossible, because it just is sort of at the whim of the government or at the whim of whoever's in charge at the time, and progress can be undone so quickly. You know, it's just like when a typhoon comes through and wipes out a whole community's worth of business. It's like the same thing, but it's just over and over again. So it's just not worth it if we're looking on being impactful and effective. We need to work in areas where that's ripe for economic development. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's good. Thank you. Yeah, sure. We have one more question. We have one more question.
What proportion of your clients are women, and what proportion are men?
94%. I think 94% are women.
Why is it so skewed?
It's a very good question. it's not because we don't like men. a couple reasons. Firstly, oftentimes in poor families, if the husband or if the man is at home, sometimes he's not. He's usually off working, sometimes hundreds or thousands of kilometers away from home. So oftentimes in poor situations, families are split. And so you have the man of the family who goes off and finds work, traveling around in different countries, etc. So oftentimes the man just simply isn't at home. And most microfinance businesses are home-based businesses. So it's most of the time it's the women who are there running the business, and the men are off in another country or another town or village working or following work as they need to. Now, there is also just the simple fact that women have been shown, research is proving, that they are spending the generated income more effectively, and they spend it in things, and I don't say this to put down the men at all, but when a woman has a business and generates more income, she tends to invest it in more long-term ways, in education, spreading out nutrition, that type of thing, more long-term focused improvements in their life, and that progresses them out of poverty more quickly. It's like pressing the fast-forward button on development. So we invest in women. We invest money where it's most effective, and it's effective when with the business owner that's at home, and it's effective with people who are going to invest their money as productively as possible and with the long-term goals in sight. So that's why we don't have a policy against lending to men. We have a lot of male clients. They're very nice people. But, yeah, so that's why. Does that answer your question? Sort of? Pardon me? The interesting questions tend to do that. I'm happy to chat with you more offline, and there's a huge amount of research done on this topic, so I'd be happy to send you some materials and chat more about it, because it is a very important point And it's a great question. So, yeah, thanks.
Thank you. And I don't really want to stop the questions, but I just know that people need to get back to work. So I did want to thank Sarah and Rebecca. But just before I do, I also want to put a plug in. Some of us have set up a micro insurance working party, and it's very early stages, just a few people who got together who were interested in it. We're looking at a couple of projects, one of which is indigenous insurance. So there's some microfinance happens in Australia, larger loans than Rebecca and Sarah have been talking about and more business focused. But anyway, so if people are interested in any of this, please contact Opportunity, but also if you'd like to contact me, I'm happy to kind of maintain a register of people who are interested and if we're looking for particular skills, because the working party at the moment has a general insurance focus, and but the interest we've had so far from on the Indigenous side is probably more likely to be on the life insurance side, so we might be looking for some help. However, thank you very, very much to Rebecca and Sarah. I've certainly found it interesting listening to them again and getting some more insight, and I hope everybody else here has enjoyed it too, so please join me in thanking them.